MacCast, Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, summer is in full force. Yes, it sure is. I'm on a little bit of a summer schedule, as I think I mentioned last episode, but also there's just a lot of things happening, at least outside the Apple and Mac world. I just got back from Nerdtacular 2017. It's a conference I've been going to for a couple of years, so if you listen to the show, you know, each summer I head out and hang out with the podcasters over at the Frog Pants Network. That's Scott Johnson's network. If you've never heard of any of the shows or you don't listen to them, you might want to check them out. You can check out frogpants.com to find those. But it's a great fun show. It's just nerd geek culture. And it's really where I go to meet up with a bunch of podcasting friends and really almost family. Like, it's a giant family reunion. You know, that's something you do every summer, right? So that's like my nerd family reunion. And it is a lot of fun. And you might be asking, Adam, why are you telling me this? Well, I'm telling you this for two reasons. One, first of all, it's summer and there's not a lot of Apple news. Let's be honest. The last week or two since Worldwide Developer Conference, there hasn't been a lot going on. Yeah, we've got iPhone 8 rumors and a few other odds and ends, but there is not a ton of stuff that we really can get deep into that we haven't already talked about. So we are going to get into some of the latest iPhone rumors, actually one that I'm not very happy about. I'll tell you about here in a second. We also have some feedback from you, a little update to what we were talking about. Somebody had asked a question about reading list in Safari, and then I have a follow-up from one of you on my theory on Apple, what Apple's doing in the car space. So we're going to talk about those two things. But every year when I go to Nerdtacular, again, if you're a regular listener, you probably know this, but one of the things that I like to do is get some of my favorite podcasters and friends, and I steal their device from them. I grab their iPhone or their iPad. I peruse through and I look for an application that I'm not familiar with. And then we just have a conversation about that app. Why is it on your phone? Why do you like it? And it's really an app discovery segment. We call it What the App Is That. It's kind of like a little bit of a game. And it came about because I think the way most of us find out about great apps is through recommendations from friends and family. We know the App Store has a little bit of a discovery problem. iOS 11 is maybe going to try to address that with this whole editorial featured applications thing. Will that work? That remains to be seen. It could, but I still think at the end of the day, a lot of us are going to get our app recommendations from friends and family. So we do that during Nerdtacular 2017. So stay tuned and you're going to get a bunch of great app recommendations from some really cool and smart people. So that's going to round out the show for today. So let's just dive right into it. Let's not waste any more time. I do want to talk about this rumor. Ming-Chi Kuo, one of our favorite analysts, our favorite predicators? Is that how you say the name of somebody who does predictions? Pontificators? I don't know. I'm horrible at vocabulary, let's be honest. But Ming-Chi Kuo came out, and he has his top 10. Let's just call them predictions for the next iPhone. And they were pretty standard stuff, a lot of the rumors that we had been hearing about. But one of the most shocking that he put out there was that Apple will not have any Touch ID fingerprint sensing technology in the iPhone 8. This goes way out of the realm of what we've been hearing about. We've been hearing about an embedded Touch ID sensor, something in the screen, possibly a Touch ID sensor moved to the back of the phone, but no one has just thrown out, no, they're just not going to have one. That's it. Gone. Done. We're over Touch ID. Why would he say that? Well, he gave a couple of reasons. One, he said that the full screen design doesn't work with any of the current existing capacitive fingerprint recognition technologies. So we do know from a number of the supply chain rumors that Apple has been having some technical challenges with this technology. And that was kind of reason number two. He said the technical challenges of a scan through fingerprint design include things like a more complex panel pixel design that Apple's been getting disappointing scan through, especially on an OLED panel. And there's been heavy rumors that the iPhone 8 is going to feature an OLED display. And also that there's weakened scan through performance due to an overlaid panel module. So the panel has many different layers to it, which is also posing a problem when you try and scan through. There had been rumors that Apple was looking for a very, very thin glass design. And I would have concerns there that that would potentially compromise the rigidity or the durability of the panel as well. So he's saying for all those reasons, that's another reason why he thinks that Apple is not going to do Touch ID at all. And the good news, if there is good news in that report, is that he says dumping the fingerprint technology means that there's no longer any more production delays. That had been one of the last big ones, so Apple can start ramping up and getting ready to go. So hopefully we will have iPhones out in time. I think they're still predicting a September launch with shipping sometime in October. We had been hearing that delays might even roll into November for the iPhone 8. So either way, as you're going to hear about in a second, again, many analysts still predicting that supplies are going to be severely constrained. Now, Kuo's report, despite some of the reporting online, does not specifically say what Apple would replace Touch ID with in terms of biometric verification, authentication. But he does list in his list of 10 predictions that Apple will have 3D sensing facial recognition technology as another big feature in the new iPhone. So many think that if Apple completely dumped Touch ID, they would go with a 3D facial recognition style technology for, I presume, everything that Touch ID currently does. And Kuo even did say in another report that their research shows that most consumers wouldn't mind a rear-placed fingerprint sensor. So I guess Apple could move the sensor to the back. But the report also specifically claims, this new report, that the OLED model will feature, quote, or won't feature, rather, or won't support fingerprint recognition. So he's saying no fingerprint technology in there. I'm not too excited about that, to be honest with you. Just as an aside, also this past week, Qualcomm and Oppo, a cell phone maker, demonstrated a prototype fingerprint sensor technology that was designed or is designed to be used through many of the common materials used in making cell phones. It's a sensor that can read actually through displays, through glass, even through aluminum. It's an ultrasonic Sense ID fingerprint sensor, and it can read through 750 micrometers of aluminum, 800 micrometers of glass, or 1200 micrometers of an OLED display substrate. And that sounded promising. A lot of people were thinking, well, there you go. Somebody has the technology. Apple must have been able to develop something similar. But the Qualcomm technology still isn't ready for prime time. This is, again, a prototype demonstration, and they say the technology isn't expected to be ready until early 2018. And that's for the aluminum and glass substrates. The actual OLED sensor, the one that would work through an OLED display, isn't even expected to be ready from Qualcomm until summer of 2018. So that's not the technology Apple is using, and that's not surprising. Apple and Qualcomm have had a pretty rocky business relationship. Yes, Apple has to work with them. It's kind of like the relationship Apple has with Samsung. But Apple and Qualcomm have been fighting specifically over cellular modem patents and licensing for a while now. So they're kind of frenemies in the same way that Samsung and Apple are. So they probably aren't too interested in using more of their technology. And it's been rumored they've been working kind of on their own stuff. So here's the deal. I so hope that this latest rumor is wrong. I love Touch ID. Many of you love Touch ID. And we need to remember, analysts, even Ming-Chi Kuo, as good as he is, they're never 100% right on Apple rumors. And Tim Cook has warned famously many times not to trust the supply chain and all these other sorts of things. So we've seen a number of different designs and ideas being thrown around. It is plausible that going with 3D facial recognition technology only is something Apple could consider. Whether that's where they land come September when we get this announcement, who really knows? I just personally don't like the idea behind it, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. If they are going to use 3D facial recognition to replace Touch ID, it has to be amazing. It has to be twice as good as Touch ID, in my opinion, as a solution, or at least better. And that's a pretty high bar to raise. And especially for something like Touch ID, where you've taken your phone out of your pocket and you're having to tap it to something that's usually pretty low on a desk. I don't want to have to pull my phone out, either tap it and then raise my phone to my face or raise my phone to my face and tap it. So it's going to have to work at really odd angles. It's going to have to be super fast at recognition, very accurate, very secure. A piece that I had read pointed out, you know, Apple has really sold Touch ID as a biometric technology to, say, the banks for Apple Pay. And they've sold them on it. And to move suddenly quickly away from it just seems really odd. There's lots of things about this rumor that just don't feel right at all. There are a few other options for keeping Touch ID but not having it integrated into the display that I read about. Of course, they could move it to the back. You know, I hate this idea, but to me it would be better than completely dumping Touch ID. And as I mentioned earlier, Quo's reports show that most people don't mind fingerprint sensors on the backs of their phones. It could be an integrated physical button, one that is there on the front of the display, but visually minimized, in my opinion. Look at how Apple integrated the fingerprint sensor into the touch bar on the MacBook Pro, and I think you see a very similar thing. We had heard rumors a while back about this sort of function area, so there was actually going to be almost two displays on the new iPhone. That has kind of faded out. But they could go that route. You know, you could have this function bar screen on the bottom that works very much like the touch bar OLED screen, and the ID sensor could be almost visually just done in a way where it's very hard to tell that there's anything there at all. So that could keep the aesthetic look, but still maintain a physical touch ID sensor. And then the final thing is I guess Apple does have a patent already for embedding Touch ID technology into the button on the side of the phone, the sleep-wake button. Again, I think just like the button being on the back, that would be a little bit awkward, but I still think that's a better solution than just completely dumping Touch ID altogether. I mean, Apple has way too much invested in Touch ID, I think, both in terms of it being an integral part of Apple Pay and all of the marketing and stuff that they've already put into it. I don't put it past them to completely dump it, but I would imagine it would have to be a real extreme scenario for them not to keep Touch ID on an iPhone. So I'm hoping it's there. I'm hoping this rumor is just weird and out there, but I'd love to know your opinion. So if you want to shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Couple other iPhone 8 things. We still have rumors of OLED display shortages. This week, we were hearing some reports that are indicating that there could be just 3 to 4 million iPhone 8 units, rather, ready to go at launch. If you put that up against the fact that Apple can sometimes pre-sell as many as 10 million units in an opening weekend for the iPhone, that gives you a rough idea of how bad the shortage of iPhones is going to be this time around. I mean, again, we've been talking about this for a while, but you may not be able to get an iPhone 8 if you want one until 2018, even if they come out in 2017. I think this is going to be a shortage to sort of end all shortage. A demand's going to be extremely high because it's a 10th anniversary edition. A brand new design always means more demand, and this one is going to be rough, folks. So just strap in and be prepared for that. Interestingly, on the display side of things, Bloomberg reported this week that the new iPhone might feature Apple's ProMotion technology. That's the 120 hertz refresh rate that they put into the new iPad Pros. And they're predicating this, or they're saying this, because apparently it's looking like the new iPhone is going to have Apple's Neural Engine chip. That's the thing that drives ProMotion, and also Apple's artificial intelligence technology. So that being integrated in the phone is another high-end feature that we've been hearing about that is going to be awesome. And it could be that chip is also in there to drive that facial recognition technology and make it super fast and quick and accurate and smart and all these other things. So if they are going to, replace Touch ID with facial recognition, it's going to have to be some of the best facial recognition in any device ever. And this could potentially make that happen. But OLED, you know, the OLED shortage is being a problem, is going to be a problem. We did see a report from the Korea Herald this week that said Apple was in talks with LG Display to possibly invest as much as 1.75 to 2.6 billion in new OLED production lines that would be exclusively dedicated to Apple orders. And that is promising, meaning that, hey, we're going to have more OLED production, except it's not going to help with the iPhone 8 because even the new facilities that they're working on right now are not expected to be ready until 2019. So it's going to be a couple years, but Apple may be just planning for the future this time around. So they're going to be buying up a lot of OLED displays. And I think Samsung is currently the largest manufacturer, so they've been working with them on that sort of thing. One other thing on the iPhone kind of screen that I want to mention, there was an odd leak that came out on Twitter from Benjamin Geskin. He's been leaking some pretty interesting stuff related to the iPhone 8 lately, and probably some of the most accurate looking stuff. This time around, though, he was showing some displays, some front panels, and what was interesting is we've been hearing for a long time that that almost edge-to-edge display with the thin bezel up at the top where the little camera sensor, the camera and sensors are, the earpiece, that sort of thing, that there was going to be this sort of little bump or tab that kind of came down in the display. And most of the display parts we had been seeing show that. This latest parts leak shows just a band going across the top. So it's a little bit thicker bezel at the top with all of the sensor parts, very much looking, in my opinion, like a Samsung phone, one of the Galaxy line. So I'm not putting a lot of stock in that. I think we are going to get the little tab. Some people have complained thinking that that little tab is just dumb. You know, there's no reason to extend the display all the way up to the edge and then have sort of these little areas on the left and right. One of the rumors we heard was that the software would actually take care of that and just integrate the OLED bar with the status symbols like Wi-Fi and battery and stuff like that right across. So you can actually use that part of the display dynamically and then still have the cutout for the sensors and the earpiece and not have it look like it's not just integrated together. Because with the rich blacks that are in OLED, it's going to be almost imperceivable. So I think Apple's still going with that design. I'm not putting much stock in this latest parts leak from Geskin, but that was thrown out there and somewhat display related. And then finally on the iPhone 8, we've had rumors about charging, Apple adding wireless charging. We haven't had a lot of details on how charging might work out, but in a latest rumor from Barclays, they say that Apple will ship the iPhone 8 with a 10-watt USB-C power adapter that would support fast charging. So you wouldn't have the old USB-A one with the lightning cable. You would actually get a USB-C one with, I would assume, a USB-C to lightning connector that you would plug into your phone. It'd be able to charge at the faster rate. Just for reference, the iPhone 7 and also the new iPads, the 12.9-inch and 10.5-inch iPads, those both already support fast charging. The problem is that you don't get an adapter in the box when you buy those that supports the fast charging. You'd have to buy right now the 29-watt USB-C MacBook charger, which I think is about $50. So it's not a cheap add-on to get fast charging currently with your devices. So this would be great news with the iPhone 8 if you could get quick charging with a new power adapter in the box that supports that. Now, as exciting as that Barclays one is, Ming-Chi Kuo contradicts this in his report, saying, you know, that list of 10 predictions, saying that there would be a standard 5-watt charger in the box. Faster charging, of course, would be supported, but again, you're going to need an optional USB-C adapter to do that. And on the wireless charging side, Kuo says that Apple will support WPC standard wireless charging that would include the Qi charging, but you're going to need to buy the induction charging accessory separately. So that's going to be a separate add-on. And I figured that was going to be the case. I didn't think Apple was going to include the induction charger in the box. They go with wired charging, which is faster and I think just as easy as an induction charging system. But a lot of people like that. Hopefully this idea that it supports the standard and is not proprietary, like the Apple Watch. You know, the Apple Watch has a quote-unquote standard wireless charging technology in it, but Apple has tweaked it in a way where it becomes proprietary and you have to use an Apple charger. I wouldn't put it past them to do that with the iPhone, but I hope they don't. I hope they leave that to third-party accessory makers to be able to make accessories that support the new iPhone wireless charging system. But with that, that is it for the news for this week. Getting to some of your feedback, a couple shows back, I think it was, we had a listener who was asking about adding the add to reading list icon, or finding a way to add an add to reading list icon to the Safari toolbar. Reading list is a great way to sort of shuffle off and keep track of articles that maybe you come across online that you want to read later. I use it a lot when I'm reading through one story and maybe they're linking to or referencing another story, and I want to be able to come back to those, read them, and then shuffle them off. Kind of like temporary bookmarks is how I use them. I think some people actually just use them in substitution for bookmarks. But you can put them in there. It syncs if you're using iCloud syncing in Safari, and you can get to the reading list on all of your devices. That's the little thing when you pull up the sidebar or the bookmarks with the reading glasses icon. So the question was, can I add that to my Safari toolbar? And I mentioned that there wasn't a way to do it, but kind of pointed out a couple of alternative options. You could use keyboard shortcut. Command-Shift-D when you're in Safari will add an item to reading list. You can also control or right-click on any link, and then in the contextual menu, there's an add to reading list option. And you can also click on the share icon, which is in the toolbar, and choose add to reading list. The problem there, of course, is it takes two clicks. So if you just had a reading list icon in the toolbar, one click and you could add it to reading list. Well, guess what? Many of you, and thank you for everybody who wrote in to say, hey, Adam, dummy, the admin, you guys didn't say dummy, I'm adding, that's my own color commentary, but this is sort of how I felt. You said, hey, there's an add to reading list icon already in the Safari toolbar, but you might have missed it because it's a little bit hidden. And I think last time we also talked about my frustration over hidden UI elements, a new favorite thing of Apple's. And this is one of them. So a big thank you to everybody who sent in this tip, because I think it's really great. So what everybody told me was, when you're on a page in Safari and you want to add it to your reading list and you want to do it from basically amounts to the toolbar in Safari, just hover your cursor over the URL bar, and on the left-hand side, there is a little plus icon that will appear magically when you're hovering in the URL bar area. It's right next to the reader icon, and if you click the little plus icon, it adds the current URL to your reading list. So there it is, right there in the toolbar, but you might not have seen it. I certainly didn't, and again, thanks to everyone who pointed that out. And then another thing that I want to follow up on before we get into our Nerdtacular extravaganza, what the app is that. Daniel wrote in to comment on a few things about my comments that I think Apple is working on a car as a service as part of their autonomous car project, the system that they're working on. So a lot of people, and Apple has actually confirmed that they're working on an autonomous car system. But I think it's all in the ultimate goal to do a service where, rather than owning a car in the future, we would just subscribe to a service from Apple or some other company, be able to instantly call up a car when we need it, have it take us where we need to go, and then it drives off, we do whatever we need to do, and then when we need to get back home, we call a car again. And we just pay for that monthly, so no more car payment, no more insurance. No more worrying about gas or anything like that. It's all going to be handled and rolled into the cost of our monthly car service. And Daniel wrote in and said, you know, that sounds pretty good, but I think there's some flaws in that logic, especially when it comes to availability. A lot of his doubt seemed to stem from being, okay, what happens for remote and rural areas? He also had some doubts about some of the cost. And again, also one of the costs being the loss of freedom of travel that a car brings to us. And I totally get this, especially in the United States, where we are very, very car dependent. We're very much a car culture. But you have to remember, too, that Apple works and operates, and we live and operate in a much more global society. So again, I 100% agree with some of your ideas, Daniel, that you sent me about, hey, for this to actually fly, there's a lot of things that need to change. There's a lot of obstacles and hurdles to overcome, and I don't doubt that. Certainly, as far as people being in rural or remote areas, it's going to be a while before any kind of car service gets out to those locations. I 100% think that this is going to be at first available in very limited areas. The rollout is going to be very much progressive, and it's not going to be ubiquitous at first, and that is going to be a challenge. It's going to be a problem. But the deal is I think it's going to get rolled out in large cities. It might not even get rolled out in the U.S. at first, and I even think Apple could roll it out as a competitive service to something like Uber or Lyft at first, and then ultimately roll it into a consumer car service. So how this happens is going to be tricky. There is no doubt about that. But I do think a car as a service could appeal to a broad range of consumers, especially in large cities. So it'll be rolled out in large cities first. I looked online in 2015, 63% of the U.S. population lived in cities, and that's according to the U.S. consensus. So there's a large percentage of consumers where Apple could deliver a car service. And I think that's how that part of it is going to happen. Will it, become completely ubiquitous to everybody across the nation? That's going to take a really long time. Daniel also brought up some issues with my cost thoughts about what the service would be. I think I had said, I think what Apple would charge for it monthly is about what you pay for a car payment. So depending upon what kind of car you have and things like that, that could be in the range of $200 to maybe $600, $800. It's a pretty broad range. I figured Apple would land somewhere in the middle, maybe around $400 a month. But Daniel said, hey, I think that's a little bit too low because car payment's not the only cost that goes into owning a car. And he did some quick math using, I'm going to call them typical car costs that may be higher or lower than what you're paying, but he factored in, a car payment, gas, insurance, maintenance, registration, came up with a figure of about $7,600 a year, which when you divide by 12 comes out to about $640, let's call it US per month. So his thought was, well, it's probably going to be more expensive than you're thinking. And if it's that much, how many people are really going to take advantage of this service? And again, I agree with you, Daniel. I think if it's $650, $700 a month, it's really going to be an elite service, and there probably isn't going to be a lot of people taking advantage of it. Is that necessarily bad? Is that something that Apple could do? Probably. Apple's pretty good at living in the premium, expensive side of the world. But I really think ultimately what they would be shooting for is a volume service, again, starting out in large cities and pricing it around the cost of, the median cost of a typical car payment. So I'm thinking $300 to $400 a month is what you would pay. And I certainly, again, think there are a lot of issues to work out around that. And not everybody is going to want this service. And I don't think that's the goal. I don't think it's 100% of people buying into this. I think this meets the needs of some people and definitely will not meet the needs of all people. There's going to be people forever that choose to just own a car. But I think we're moving in this direction where we're going to have a future where a lot of people don't own a car and don't want to own a car. And this kind of a service is going to fill the void. And, just as I got your email, there are a couple other issues I thought to sort out. Again, thinking the rural thing, if it's deployed in cities, how do you handle something like long distance travel? What if I want to get in my autonomous car service and I want to drive to rural Kansas, but rural Kansas doesn't have an Apple car service? Does the car drive itself back? What happens when I need to get back home, right? These are issues. Do I have a way to kind of reserve the car for an extended period of time? Is there an added cost? There's lots of things that need to be sorted out for this. And on the, freedom thing, I think you have a great point. The freedom of owning a car, knowing that I have a car in my driveway right now, I can jump in it, I can take it whenever I want, wherever I want, do whatever I want with it. That kind of freedom does go away if you subscribe to a car service. But I think what could happen is this could allow families that maybe have two cars or multiple cars, become a one car family. So maybe you have the one car and the car service, and between those two things, in a family of four or five, six people, you can actually service everybody's needs and not have to own two vehicles or three vehicles, something like that. It also opens up the possibility of access to variable types of vehicles being your second vehicle. What if I need a larger vehicle because I want to take all my kids to the same place? Well, I could order up a different style of vehicle. Again, will there be a tiered cost for that? Who knows? What if I need a truck? You know, I want to do some yard work one weekend and I need a larger vehicle. I can order that sort of vehicle to meet my needs just for that one moment. And I don't have to own all kinds of different kinds of cars or borrow them from friends or whatever. So a car service to me sounds very, very interesting. I do think it's something that people will want in the future. And I do still firmly believe it's one of Apple's long-term goals with their autonomous car platform. I think they're driving towards that kind of technology, that kind of disruption in the future. But again, that's just my opinion. Daniel, I very much appreciate you writing in and sharing your opinion and thoughts on this. And I welcome anybody else in the MacCast community to send their thoughts and opinions along as well. But with that, that is going to do it for the feedback. Now, I want to get into our What the App Is That segment, Nerdtacular 2017. This was an amazing show. Unfortunately, it was the last one in this format, as you're going to hear Scott talk about here at the beginning. But if you did miss this one, there are videos and up and available of all of the sessions, all the things that they did there on the Twitch channel for Frog Pants, which is the network that runs Nerdtacular. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. You can check those out. A lot of fun. They do some of their shows streaming live. There was a great video games panel. So if you're into video games, you might want to check that out. Great performances by Paul and Storm and a bunch of other great stuff. So check out the videos. But let's dive in. We're going to start off talking to Scott Johnson a little bit about Nerdtacular, what that is all about. I also wanted to ask him about his feelings on Pro Macintoshes because he's very much a Pro Mac user. So we talked to him about that a little bit. And then we get into all of the What the App Is That picks from a number of people. Hammond Chamberlain, Brian Ibbett. And just for reference, I have to apologize to Brian. I always say Brian Ibbett, like it's two D's. It's I-B-B-O-T. Brian Ibbett of Coverville, Dan Patrice, and Tom Merritt. So here we go. Nerdtacular 2017 and What the App Is That?
Nerdtacular 2017, the 10th Nerdtacular. And here's the man that made it all happen, what, 10 years ago, I guess, right? Amazing. Scott Johnson. So we're going to talk to Scott a little bit. I want to talk to you about Macs, and then we'll get into our What the App Is That pick. But I guess we should maybe start just with Nerdtacular. 10th year, a lot of stuff happening, changes. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So there's been a lot of talk about how not only is this the 10th year, but I've made a lot of rumblings about it being the last year, and in some ways it will be. I don't know what that actually means, though. Like, I say that, but I know that we're going to have community stuff and more things down the road. The question is, will it take the same format? Probably not. I feel like 10 years is a good break for that, to be able to say, all right, we've done this. What do we want to do next? And what we do next may be very similar to it. It may be slightly different. My thinking is get me out to more places where the people are, less than having them all try to come here, and spread that out during the year a little bit. But also beef up some of the other appearances I already do at BlizzCon and other events. But part of me is very nostalgic for this and doesn't want to see it go outright. So there's some rumor that a bunch of people are going to rent this ballroom next year at the same time and just have board games all weekend. And I thought, well, I'd go to that.
Yeah, I've heard the same rumor.
I would totally go to that. Like, I wouldn't have to even ask. I would just totally be here. So some would say, well, why aren't you just doing it then? Well, part of it is, it's a huge thing to organize. It's a giant pain in my butt, and it's worth it, but it's also extremely exhausting. And it happens, it's not just the weekend that's exhausting. It's all year. It's all the planning. It's all the stuff. It's the sheer anxiety of making sure everything's in place. And then it always goes well. Like, our anxiety is well spent, but I think it changes just good. And we've kind of, you know, done this, and I think maybe this may have been the best year we've had. Certainly the most people and the most diverse people. So if this is the last of this format, truly, it is the best one to go out on because I feel really good about it.
Yeah, it's totally amazing. As a attendee, I can tell you this was probably the best one. I love the single format and stuff like that. So for people who don't know, you know, Nerdtacular, just a big celebration of geeks. You have the Frog Pants Network, which is your network with all your shows, the Morning Stream, Film Sack, Current Geek, yeah, with Tom Merritt, and all those people come up here and we just hang out and nerd out and have a good time. So thank you for continuing, you know, to do that in whatever form that takes.
Sure.
Yeah. So people will be out. You need to get out to Gen Con, right?
I mean, I want to. Gen Con's a cool place. In fact, we had kind of this mini Gen Con last night, and I thought, well, we need to go to an actual Gen Con, but there usually is a conflict on dates. This year, we got lucky and didn't happen. Sometimes what happens is we announce early, and then something gets announced. Like Denver Comic Con, which was the same weekend, and we had a lot of people from Denver here. They announced their dates the same weekend, but like months after we did. And that always happens. Last year it was Gen Con that conflicted. The year before that it was something else. Then we had somewhere it was on the 4th of July weekend, which meant that, you know, we were kind of messing with people's family plans and everything. And so this year I think was the best possible shot to get for dates. Because we now live in a 2017 reality that is there is a con every weekend in every city, all the time, everywhere, nonstop. So there's always something for you to go see. In this very saturated market, this thing's just, it's not really even a con. It's like a, I don't know what it is. It's like a family reunion. It's crazy. And I got a really good vibe this year. I felt like a lot of really great people came, had really good experiences. I'm unaware of any negative anything. There was an elevator that sort of broke down, I heard about, but everyone was fine. Nobody had to eat anybody or pick a leader. But I'm going to miss this. In 2 months, we'll see how I'm feeling. Sometimes I just need that time to kind of back off from it and then think, well, what am I going to do? And I don't exactly know, but I know that having you here has always been a pleasure. So, Adam, thank you for always coming, man. It's always been good to have you here.
Appreciate it. So stay tuned to Frog Pants Network, and there'll be more on that. I want to get into Mac stuff, though. I really do with you, because we have you on the show a lot of times. You're an artist. You are a podcaster, so you're using a lot of this stuff at the pro level. Right. And for a long time, we've been waiting on Apple to do some pro stuff, and WWDC that happened. And we haven't talked since then. So what do you think about the new Macs, the direction of the pro and all that stuff?
Well, the upgrades to the notebooks actually got me to buy a MacBook, which I'm holding right here in my hands. Nobody can see this, but I picked up a Space Gray. I don't know what the line is now, because it was for a long time. MacBooks were the cheap end.
Right.
Airs were the high end. Pros were a question. Now pros are unquestionably the high end. I don't know the future of Air. I think the future of Air is they're the low end, if they stay around at all. And this is something else. It's weird how they've done that. But I kind of have fallen in love with this thing. I really, really like it a lot. The trackpad is incredible. It's second generation, so it's got all the new upgrades they talked about at that event. So that was one big thing for me for this Apple event. And it's been a few Apple events since I've gotten a big new thing. I'm still using a Mac Pro trash can tower looking thing from, what was that, 2013 they were introduced?
Yeah.
I got the first revision of that, and it's still screaming fast, doing everything I needed to do. I am in no rush to upgrade. So when they got on stage and said nothing about that revision, although they are talking about that's coming with more of a modular approach and all of that, which is great, I think. But they did announce the iMac Pro. And while that is a sexy beast and I would love one, I can't justify the cost. Now, I even priced it out, a PC equivalent out, and it's roughly the same price. So it's not. This isn't an Apple gouge. They are really making a sweet piece of premium hardware, no question in my mind. Fastest thing they've got. And with a built-in screen and all the other benefits, it really is something to behold. And normally, I'd be all over it. It's not enough of a bump from what I'm using. How they would have gotten me, though, is if they would have finally made a pencil-compatible screen. If they would have gone full iPad Pro capability for the art, and I can lean that thing down, kind of, you know, Microsoft Surface Pro Studio style,
sure, yeah.
Which I don't like, by the way. That thing I tried it. I wanted it to be good. I was this close. Bleh. Not great. Slow, laggy, beautiful idea. One-ups Apple in idea department as far as I'm concerned, but kind of blows it on execution. If they would have done that, even if it wasn't a touchscreen in the traditional like operating system ways, just for art, just for drawing, I would have been all in, like 100% justify the cost, would probably have one on pre-order right now. But they didn't do that, and it's unfortunate because I think there's an opportunity there for professionals, especially artists. I think this thing was aimed mostly at editors and video folks, and that's great. a lot of developers are telling me they're excited about that box. So there's a lot of reasons to be stoked about it. But at 4,000 whatever starting price, it's just, I can't do it. I can't justify it.
Yeah, it's nuts. 5K is a little bit to invest. I found it interesting that you went with a MacBook. The last thing I want to talk to you about on this is, so you mentioned, you know, if they had a desktop with a pencil. I think you have an iPad Pro Apple Pencil thing, and we've talked about that. I think we had you on the show to talk about that, and it's amazing, right? I think we did some comparisons. Were you tempted by the new iPad Pros because the pencil's even faster now, and I didn't think it was possible?
Yeah, I mean, what I was hoping for was a revision to the Pro, because my goal is hand this down to my artist daughter, get the new one. It's how I do most of my art stuff. She has my old Wacom, for example, and I have a newer one. So we were looking forward to that. I still am. I have it through some pretty good sources that we're going to see a revision to the 12 point whatever inch by December. So if that's true, that'll be a nice bump. I'll do that. And I suspect that would be the kind of spec upgrade that this 10.9 is. 120 hertz screen, better pencil capability. I'm still a little confused on the pencil, though. Is it only faster with the new? Is there a new pencil?
No.
Same pencil.
Yeah, it was always capable of 120. They just didn't have the other side of the equation.
Okay, that makes me even happier, because I was thinking I was going to have to shell out for a whole new pencil and then wait forever because they're always backordered. But all that being said, it's still the most accurate pinpoint precision controlling pen to tablet device I've ever used, and I've compared them all. I've tried all the Surfaces. The best one was Surface 2, by the way, for anyone wondering, and that's because it was a Wacom pen and engine. They don't do that anymore, and it's worse for it. But for me, it goes iPad Pro in terms of precision, accuracy, and just flow. And the new one, the 10-point whatever, is the same. What is it, 10.9, is it? I used one yesterday just 25. Fiddling with it. It's just as fast, looks great. You can clearly see a difference in refresh rate, and that is definitely something I want in the future. But again, it's already better than anything else I'm using. Wacom is below that with enough lag to be noticeable, but still good for pro work or whatever. And then in third place is everybody else. They just don't know what they're doing yet. But it's such a nice, happy surprise, because it's the one place I feel like Apple truly remembered what I want their products for. And I realize I'm a unique case. That's why they called it a Pro, I guess, because it's people who want to do professional things with them. But it's nice to be able to get a product from them that actually solves a bunch of problems for me. I still have some issues with app support from like Adobe and some other people, and that none of that's gotten too great in the last year. But there are other apps made by unknowns like Procreate and other things that are incredible. So on the whole, and some changes coming with 11 are going to make my life a lot easier in terms of file management and kind of productivity. So I really like that direction. What their ultimate goal with that is in terms of competing with their desktops or their laptops, I don't know. But I'm extremely excited about what potential is behind this. And they certainly have numbers on how they're selling. I assume it's been doing well, or they wouldn't have made the smaller one with the bigger, less bezel and pencil, all that. So very excited about that and Apple's commitment. And I hope it sticks.
Yeah. I think it's a great, great bump up. And I think you're right. They're selling them just fine.
I almost forgot my favorite new product right here in my pocket. So I think if you're going to say, I'm going to say pound for pound, the coolest thing Apple's made in the last 5 years are these AirBuds. AirBuds, right?
AirPods.
I keep saying AirBuds like the movie AirBud, like the dog that was played basketball. Creator, yeah, stupid. I love these. They're amazing. Like, literally, they do everything they promised they'd do. And then a few things I didn't know about. Switching over on my Mac with, like, a click of a mouse, suddenly I've now got these things on. The distance I can go from my phone before I forgot that I don't have my phone with me is way farther than anything else I've ever used. Sound quality is great. It's genius to be able to, I know this isn't entirely new, but the way this little thing works is to take them out and put them in their resting place where they charge, and then charge that when it needs it. And I feel like I'm never at a loss for power. They're amazing. So huge props to Apple for this one. I don't know where it came from, but I'm glad they did it.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I think Walt Mossberg this week said that, or is predicting that sales of that will generate more revenue than the Apple Watch for Apple. Wow. We'll see if that happens. They are amazing, and the bummer is still hard to get. All right, last thing I want to talk about, we were going to do What the App Is That. We're kind of cheating a little bit because you did a thing on stage with this app where you were doing a live storytelling drawing thing with Terpster, and it was amazing. So you want to tell people what the app is and then sort of mention how you were using it and stuff like that.
So, oh man, what a fun thing that was. I was really concerned about it when I was planning it because I've never done that and live, and I didn't know how I would do just personally, like drawing in front of everybody. It's just a weird thing. Doing it on the internet is no big deal, but doing it in front of a huge crowd is strange. And we had Mark the Terpster Turpin over there telling a story. We had music in the background. And as he told that story, I would illustrate certain bits and improv a little bit. And it got big laughs, like we were having a really good time. So the way I made it work, actually, before I mention this, my other favorite thing is that Keynote on the phone now lets you run Keynote presentations on whatever device you're running them on. So if it's an iPad or a Mac, I use them on my MacBook. And that thing lets you visually essentially be that second screen and have it in your hand, but also I can annotate. I freaking love that. So I can pause and like circle somebody's head in red. It's like John Madden or whatever. It's awesome. Super impressed with that update. But anyway, and Keynote, by the way, still the top thing for presentations. I tried to use PowerPoint just to, it sucks. It's not good. Keynote rocks. I freaking love Keynote. Anyway, this isn't about Keynote. So I brought with me an Apple TV and I thought, the sound system here and the audio system was all upgraded to 1080p widescreen from last time, which was 4x3 in the old days, and 2 years ago. And so what we did is, since everything is HDMI now, brought the Apple TV, connected that to the main system, and then I AirPlayed the iPad using Procreate to the Apple TV, which was real-time art up on a screen. Now, I could have done it with an AV adapter or something, but I love the idea that literally with two simple pieces of hardware, I'm doing something that sounds like wizardry just a few years ago. It's really great. It's incredible. And it was one-to-one. It looked great. There was no degradation, literally just a Wi-Fi between the devices. And it looked great, came off wonderful, even recorded well on the stream. Could not be happier. And at the center of it is this very great, easy-to-use, but also, you know, so much to master art application called Procreate. And a lot of people have heard about it. If you're drawing on the iPad at all, you've heard of Procreate. You have to. It's just sort of like the standard right now. And it just performed beautifully. Everything about that went great. So now we're, like, talking about ideas of how to do that again and how and where. Maybe it's a YouTube series or who knows. But I literally couldn't have done that and had one of the funnest panels of the entire event without just these simple crossover technologies. So it's that, and AirDrop has become huge for me. We talked about this on Twitter a couple days ago, and a lot of people poo-poo it for I don't know why.
Had a huge response.
Yeah, a lot of back and forth. Some people love it. Some are saying, well, it's great when it works, and I'm like, it's never not worked for me, ever. It always works. I never have it not work, so I don't know what that problem is. But yeah, early on, yeah. And I didn't use it as much early on, so I feel like I've kind of come at the right time. It's like buying a video game after it's patched, and you're like, oh, this was a great experience, and I don't remember the crashes it was having, but I had 600 to 800 megabyte presentation files. In the old days, it'd be, all right, put it to Dropbox, and then loop it back around home. That's terrible. That's a bad idea. Your bandwidth that's a bad use of bandwidth. Instead, I literally just go, burnt, 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 and they're over there in seconds. I've got everything I need. I'm synced up. I'm ready to go. And it was beautiful. So that entire experience, I mean, it's more than just an app, but you have a great app in the first place. You have a great way to communicate between these devices. And ultimately, that presentation just straight up wouldn't have worked without it. So I'm fanboying a little bit. But right now, I've been, you know, last couple of years, a little like this with Apple. It's like, guys, you're not addressing what you used to give me. You're not giving me what I used to get. Where's true final cut? Where's, you know, why is everything getting dumbed down, or why are you forgetting about the pro community? But I've kind of come around. I feel like they're getting back to it, and maybe some of that's pressure from Microsoft and others that are saying, well, yeah, we're putting a flag in this because Apple's, you know, they've left some space, so we're going to do it. And maybe that'll get them off their butts, but it's once in a while it's so good to be reminded. When Apple does this right, nobody does it better. And it just made my life easier all weekend.
Yeah. The integration of the technologies, I think, is a big thing that Apple has an advantage on. And to see them finally kind of leveraging it in really big, significant ways. I mean, with technologies like AirPlay and AirDrop and all these things, and we're just getting to reap the benefits of that right now. And this recommitment to the pro community, I think, was, again, a big deal, and I think you're absolutely right. I think it was Apple recognizing, oh, we've left some space, and our competitors are right there. Like, they maybe thought they weren't paying attention, and they found out real fast that they were. And so this is going to be a great year for pros. I think 2017 is the year, and it'll say a lot. You know, come the end of the year, when those machines hit and when they show off that Mac Pro, whatever that is, it's going to be either great and a big deal, or we may be in trouble. And I don't know which way it's going to go at this point. Right now, just based on what they showed with the iMac Pro, I think it's going to be freaking amazing.
Even the entire iMac line has got such a boost this time around that you can get pretty pro without it. I mean, like, if anything, I feel like there's a marketing problem there where it's kind of like the MacBook problem in a weird way. It's like what used to be your entry level thing is still now your entry level thing, but they've boosted those things to be pretty solid. Like, they're not that far off from what the Pro is offering in terms of raw performance for what most people are going to be doing. So I wish there was a better way to express that to people so they understood that if you don't have $5,000 for the minimum spec iMac Pro, there's a really great option just under that for a whole lot less money. That's damn close. Brian Ibbett's doing this. He saw that Pro and said, I'm doing it. Heard the price, went, I can't do it. And then the other Macs really shaped up, and he was like, well, why wouldn't I do one of these? So they really shored that stuff. That's just across the board. And it doesn't feel like they're just making machines for my mom. It feels like they're making machines for, I don't know, they're kind of getting back to, these are for everybody. These are going to benefit you no matter what you're doing. And without making the pro community feel like they're being left behind for the masses, that's so important for me, specifically for me, for Apple. That's so paramount for me to stay with it. And this was a good year for them to do that to me, because I was starting to feel it. I was starting to feel like, well, I'll just go build a $3,000 custom PC and finally make that dumb change. I don't want to, but if that's how I'm going to get my pro done, I get my pro done. And now I don't feel that way. I'm going to wait for the more modular Mac Pro solution, whatever that is. They hinted at it and that's it, but whatever they've learned from the garbage can day, and I love that thing, but it's time for something. That was 2013. It's time.
Well, cool, Scott. Thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I know you're super busy. You're trying to get out of here. It's the end of the show. I'm going to let you go. Is there any last thing you want to let people know about, what you're up to, where they should go to check out Frog Pants stuff, all that sort of thing?
Sure. If you want to see kind of what this whole Nerdtacular thing is about, we'll be putting up a bunch of new photos and videos, but the previous years that we've done, I kind of have all compiled over at nerdtacular.com. That'd be fun for people to check out if they haven't. We have recorded live streams of all of it that are up on YouTube now. So all of that stuff's out there. Just Google it and find it. But frogpants.com will be kind of a good central place to find that. All the shows we do, which is where all these people come from. The comics that I create and draw, which is where a lot of them also come from. So if you're curious about what, I guess, started all this, you can find all that content there. And follow me on Twitter, because that's usually where I'm announcing things, letting people know what's up, at Scott Johnson on Twitter. Oh, and thanks, by the way. I love this. This is one of my favorite traditions at this show. In fact, if we don't do this next year, how am I going to... We should just do a thing over the... Yeah, or something. We need to talk again.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get you on the show. I mean, you come back on the show whenever you want. You have an open invitation. So thanks, Scott. I appreciate it.
Thanks. You bet.
All right, we're playing What the App Is That here at Nerdtacular 2017, and I have Hammond. We have perused through the iPad here, and I cheated a little bit here because I know that Hammond's a music guy. So we found some cool-looking music apps. There's actually a bunch on here, but we're going to focus on one, something called Launchpad that I haven't seen before. So I'm going to ask you, Hammond, what the app is that?
So Launchpad is actually kind of an interesting app because it gives you preset rhythms and patterns that you can mix and match. And what's nice is you can also alter them and set them with other kind of sound patches if you buy the... It's a free app, but if you buy the other noises for it, you can change it up. But as you go through, you can build drum patterns, and then you can add percussion, bass, melody, and then add vocals, and it changes it on the fly, and it's a party on your iPad.
So if you want to, like, set up the party, you can do that with this app. So I'm looking at it just so people can get an idea of the interface. Basic interface, it's got a number of different, it's basically a grid. And you've got different elements, drums, percussion, bass, vocals, melodic elements. It sounds like you can get some add-ons. So these are just like the pre-built-in ones. Now, everything is color-coded, it looks like?
Yeah, so for all the drums, they're set one color. That way you can know quickly what you're looking at. You can get the drums, basses in blue, melody lines are in pink, then vocals are in green, and then the FX shots are in yellow. And then you can add additional effects to it, too, by messing with stutters, auto filters, stoppers, flangers, gaiters, all kinds of stuff. So
it also looks like there's some filters and things like that. And it looks like everything is saying 4 right now. So I'm assuming that's in reference to like beat patterns.
Yeah, it keeps everything in a 4/4 pattern. And then you can change that as you get more complicated and as you get into the app. You can also go through and change the beats per minute for it, make things slower, faster. So it's actually pretty good. And then you can build songs, add effects, do the pads live. I mean, it's pretty versatile for initially a free program.
And so, I mean, how are you just using this for fun, or are you using this actually for production work, and does it integrate into other workflows and those sorts of things?
So far, I'm using it just for fun. My music, I play the Chapman stick, so it doesn't really mix with dance music, but this is really, really fun just to mess with and turn some beats on and pretend like you're one of those LA DJs on occasion.
So it's free out of the box. It looks like it has a pretty good library of free sounds and things like that. But you can, it looks like there's a store, and then additional sound packs or add-in items are available as well.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of things you can pick up through the network as in-app purchases, and it can change everything from what drums you use and what kind of instrumentation are available to you to what kind of filters are available.
So in here under filters... So you've got some sliders and things like that, so that it's looking like you can adjust each sort of... So I've got a drum line, or it looks like I've got a number of different tracks, I guess, is what we're looking at, right?
So what it does is within that certain line, it changes the amount of sound that comes through. I mean, sometimes it's more muffled sounding, then sometimes it's more bright. Sometimes it adds tenor or treble to it and changes the pitch of the sound.
Okay, so you can do all kinds of... Just that kind of filtering or pitch filtering. This looks very, very cool, and looks like there's also a time beat indicator too. Like we're at 126 now, and that can maybe be adjusted.
Yep, you just go in there and tap to change the beats per minute, and you can make things faster and slower. Also, it has MIDI sync, which I didn't know until just now.
So very full featured. Like, hey, if you want to do your own house music and start up a house party, this would be a fun app to play around with. And well, that's what I love about this little segment is that, you know, this is all about app discovery and finding things that we may not otherwise find. So,
and one of the things we learned just while experimenting was that it plays in the background. So you could actually open up another music app and play over the top without having to use that Autobus feature or any of those other kind of routing apps that are out there.
Right. So you could really kind of start to mix together things. And I'm assuming, you know, there's ways you could obviously, I saw a record button in there, so you can record and capture the stuff and maybe bring it into another application. Say you want to bring some of your sounds and your beats into something like GarageBand and do more with them.
Yeah, I like GarageBand, but I like working with Cubasis much better just because it's more full-featured. GarageBand's kind of the starter app.
Right.
Then you get into the others, and there's a whole lot more of a world to open up.
Yeah, even on the iPad. Well, very, very cool. Thank you for walking us through this and showing us this. I know you do a number of things in the podcasting world as well. I mean, you're part of the Frog Pants Network, and you help out with them and associated with them. So you want to tell people, you know, what you're up to these days and where they can check out what you're doing?
So the Frog Pants show that I do is called Soundography, and it's a crash course in music, one band at a time, that I do with Brian Ibbett, who's famous for Coverville. And then I do a show called Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C, where I interview people who do creative things.
Very, very cool. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
We're playing What the App Is That. I've got Brian Ibbett, host of Coverville, and also FilmSack, among other things. We have perused through his iPhone and run across an app that I am not familiar with. I have a feeling I know the theme, though. So, Brian... Pokegenie. What the app is that?
Pokegenie is an add-on or an additional tool you can use with Pokemon Go. So obviously, big game from last year, Pokemon Go. A lot of people got it. 650 million people downloaded. 65 million people are still playing it. So they lost they lost 90% of their market. But 65 million is still nothing to sneeze at.
Right.
and PokeGenie helps you find the best Pokemon in your collection. Now, there are a lot of apps out there that make you log into your Pokemon Go account, and that's bad. You don't want to do that. You'll probably get shadow banned if you do that.
Wait. Yeah. For those of us who aren't, like, Pokemon crazy, like somebody I've learned at Nerdtacular, who may also have a Pokemon podcast, potentially. What does that mean, shadow banning?
Okay, so shadow banning is something that Niantic can do if they feel you're playing the game illegally. And the two methods of illegal play are botting and spoofing, where pretty much you're making the game think you're in a location that you aren't really in. And it allows you to get Pokemon that are rare or that are even not available in your country. So there's a few Pokemon that are region exclusives. There's, you know, North America, South America, Asia, Australia.
So as our friend Brian Brushwood would put it, hacking the system.
Hacking the system, exactly. So if you get caught hacking the system, what Niantic will do is shadow ban you, which is not make you would not completely cut off your access to the game, but actually put a little red slash through the Pokemon you've gotten through illegal methods, and you can't basically do anything with those Pokemon. They're useless.
All right, so now that we've learned a little bit about Pokemon, so this is going to let me manage, and I'm not going to get in trouble for using this.
Not at all. This is there's no connection from this app to your account. What's really cool about this is that you'll go into the regular Pokemon Go game, and you'll open up a Pokemon that you're curious about. You want to know if it's a decent one. We'll look at this Charizard right here. So we pull up the Charizard, and we take a screenshot of it. And then we hop back over into PokeGenie, and it automatically sees that you've added a new screenshot to your screenshots collection on your phone. And it adds it now. We'll look at new, and we'll type in Charizard. Whoops, and we'll type in Charizard and see. And what it's going to do is tell us the stats of that Pokemon. Oops, let's do it under there. There we go. And it's telling me that that Charizard has got great IVs. Now, IVs are the things that determine how well your Pokemon do in gyms or in raids, in other battles, basically. And the higher your levels, the better the Pokemon is, and the faster you can take down the gym, take down the boss, whatever. So what this is telling me is that the Charizard I just took a picture of is an 84% IVs, meaning it's got, of the 45 available IVs, it's got 38 of the 45, which is really good, 84%, which means that, and it even tells you, it's got a B rating for both defending and attacking a gym. So this is one, it's something you'd use if you are clearing out all your Pokemon. You want to know, which ones should I keep, which ones should I evolve, which ones should I just get rid of? This one will tell you, hey, this one's good to use in a gym, save it, and don't get rid of it. Get rid of some of the other ones.
Right. So it's basically an app for knowing what... This is a big part of the game I could never figure out, right? It's like, I don't know what these Pokemon are and what's good yet.
Oh, I know. Right, exactly. And this will even, you know, allow you to do some theory crafting and say, okay, if I go into simulating the power-up and evolution, let's say I'd like to power up that Charizard, it's going to say, okay, you need to be 34 to do it, which is good. I'm level 34. It's going to cost you 117 candies and 123,000 dust to take it to its best level, which would be roughly around somewhere between 2494 and 2143, which would be 2431 by its estimation. And then you can use that to kind of compare, okay, this other one would be a little bit better. I'm going to save the other one. It's basically a way of saying, all of you Pokemon, get up in a line. I want to pick the very best ones and get rid of the rest of you.
So this is really an app for people who are getting into Pokemon Go and want to know how to actually be able to win when they're going into gym battles and things like that.
And it's perfectly fair, perfectly legal. Niantic has no problem with it because it's not a security risk. It doesn't go into your system. You're taking a screenshot, and then this app is reading that screenshot.
So this data, this is all data you would be able to figure out on your own anyway?
Correct. It's looking at the key elements of the Charizard. So the CP count at the top, and then the HP count, what type it is, and what the two moves are. And it bases its rating on what those elements are.
So it's really just letting you kind of process that information more easily. All right. Very, very cool. Well,
The little interruption, but yes. So looks like a great app if you're into Pokemon Go, and it's going to help you out, and you're going to do better, and maybe something I can actually use to actually finally figure out what the heck is going on in the game, because I have no clue. I'm listening to you talk and going, I don't know what any of this is, right. But I'm sure many of you out there probably do. So this is an app you should check out. Remind me the name of the app again.
It is called Poke Genie, PokeGenie.
Okay, awesome. So download that in the App Store if you're into Pokemon Go. Sounds like a good one. Brian, I know you're involved in a ton of stuff. We mentioned a couple things. Any other things you want to let people know about? And if they want to kind of follow you, check out what you're doing and maybe the Pokemon thing.
Sorry. I think for sure, as it's related to this, the Pokemon Go podcast. It's a weekly podcast we do for both the casual and the serious players of the game. It's lighthearted. It's kid safe, so you can feel good about your children listening to it. And we talk about the game, what's coming up in it. We get the announcements from Niantic and talk about what it might mean for the game. You can hear chanting in the background. They're saying my name. So it's a really good podcast for fans of the Pokemon Go game.
Perfect. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Adam. My pleasure.
At Nerdtacular 2017 with Dan now. We're playing What the App Is That? I have perused through his phone, come across an app. It looks like it's going to be a fun one. Cult Express. So, Dan, what the app is that?
So Cult Express is a real fun game from Asmodee. It's a port from from the analog tabletop game into the digital space by Asmodee Digital. And it's a game where you're actually, everybody is robbing a train. So everybody's a different type of ne'er-do-well on a train, and everybody has their own little, has a special ability as well. And you're playing cards face down in order, and then things resolve in the order from top to bottom. So you're playing these cards where it'd be like you're moving, or you're going to the top of the train, or you're picking up loot. So you're basically, there's loot all over the train, and or you can punch or shoot each other. And there's no death or anything in the game. You're just kind of, you accumulate these other cards, and you're kind of gumming up the cards of the deck of the other people. So it's kind of like a deck building game where you're building up your deck, and you can get negative things in your deck, so that all of a sudden you may not have a whole lot of choices of what you can do. And if you're good at your memorizing what other people have played there, you can figure out where they might be, so whether you can punch them. So if you use a punch card to hit somebody, they'll drop a piece of loot in that car. If you shoot them, they just get a bullet card to do that. So there's actually a story mode, which is kind of like a little campaign mode. It's a little solo mode where you can play versus the computer and do kind of learn the game a little bit better. There's also the classic mode where you can play, I believe it's they have a pass and play and an online version as well, so that you can play. And what's really good is there's different phases. So there's times where you're playing cards face up, so other people can see what's coming. And then there's other times where you're playing cards face down, so you really have no idea where people are going. And you play it over a number of rounds, and at the end, everybody adds up how much money they have. If you've gotten rid of the most amount of bullets or you shot people the most times, you get a certain amount of money as well. And then the game ends. So it's a nice, quick, very quick filler game. There was a sale, sorry, future people. But there was a sale right now. I think it was only about $3 for the app, but I think it's at most $4.99 or $5.99 game. But it's an excellent game, and a tabletop game is even better because it's such a light. It's a gateway game that anybody can get into. This is what I call a perfect family holiday game, because you can whip it out after Thanksgiving dinner, and even Grandma and Grandpa can play this with no problem whatsoever.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. It looks. I mean, I love the artwork. I love the theme. Like, I love this idea of, Western robbing a train kind of thing. I'm into Westerns and things like that. So I think that appeals to a lot of people. So as a game, it's a card game then. And you were mentioning cars. So how does it, how does it lay out when you're playing the game?
So you have, I believe there's about five different train cars. There's also actually a sheriff that's on the car that's not controlled by anybody. But if you play the sheriff card, you can move into, you move it into a certain train. So you'll have five cars. There's the caboose and the very front, the locomotive. And there'll be a briefcase, I believe, that's at the very front, which has the most money in it. Because they'll have a couple of different, and these are all, the money varies, because there'll be like a little coin purse, or there'll be like a jewel, and then there's the briefcase. So you can never be in the same car as the sheriff, because you'll have to drop some money, I believe, and then you get pushed out of that car. So people are trying to also, not only are they trying to get your money or shoot you, but they're also trying to get you into the car with the sheriff. So there's about five or six cars, you're kind of you, and you can use the when you go on top of the train, you can move a little bit further because you can move almost. I think you can move an extra train car on top, and then you have to use a card to go either up or down. And everybody has secret abilities, which is cool because one character's key secret ability is that he can play one card down whenever he wants. You know, at any time in the game, you can play either the first card or any card face down. There's another character that you can never punch them. I think it's Belle. She's too pretty, so you can't shoot her. You can't punch her. If there's somebody else in the car, you have to punch them first. So they're little quirky things like that that are a ton of fun in it.
Sort of mix up the gameplay a little bit. So sounds like an awesome title. And I know, Dan, you're a big board game guy. I'm a big board game guy. Part of the reason we come to Nerdtacular is this event has an awesome board game room. So pick this one up. Remind me the name again.
It's called Cult Express. You'll find it on the App Store. And Asmodee Digital has a lot of sales all the time, so definitely check it out. And check out some of their other titles, because they have Potion Explosion is also by Asmodee Digital. Mysterium is by them. So they've got a lot of good titles, and they're starting to pump them out, because they just created... Asmodee is one of the largest publishers right now. They keep basically absorbing all these other companies. They're actually they're merged with Fantasy Flight, Asmodee and Fantasy Flight. So they have a lot of good properties to use, and they have a digital division now that's just pumping out the games very... And they're high quality games. So keep an eye on them for publishing.
Yeah, I like this a lot too, because if you're into board games, look at the digital ones sometimes. It's a good way to kind of get in and also learn the game. So if you're thinking about buying something, you can kind of try it out in a certain way. I think a lot of times it's hard to translate them. And I played some Asmodee things too, and I think they've done a very good job with most of the stuff that I own. But it's a great way to get in and then figure out the game before you buy it.
Yeah, one of the great things about playing an app is that they usually have a tutorial or the rules on there, and when it's in an app form, the computer doesn't mess up rules. Like when I learn a game, there's usually, every time we learn a game for the first time, there's something I mess up. You know, no matter how many games you've played in your life, when you play a game for the first time, there's something you'll miss. So when you play it or learn it on the app, you know, it may not completely translate, but it definitely gives you a good head start to learning the game. So that's what I love about picking up apps. I mean, things like Lords of Waterdeep, you know, it does the rules perfectly. So that's what I love about that. And it, plus being so portable and, you know, by yourself, if you're on, you know, going on a long plane trip, hey, I can play some board games.
Yeah, and you're heading out here. So thanks for showing us the app and talking to us. I know you do podcasts, you do other things. Anything you want to let people know about?
Yeah, you can find me basically every other Thursday. You can find me on TMSPM doing a board game segment, or check out the Geek All-Stars podcast, which is my show. We're primarily a board game show, but we do a lot of geek culture, and we'll talk about movies, other video games, and TV and stuff like that, but primarily board games, and we just have a blast.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks. It's an honor and privilege, and great to see you, and hopefully I don't take another 3 years before I see you.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see each other soon. Take care. I'm with Tom Merritt, Daily Tech News Show here at Nerdtacular 2017. We're just kind of wrapping up. Actually, it was an awesome show. And as we do, this has become a tradition for me on the MacCast. We do What the App Is That. So I have browsed through Tom's device here, and I found an app that I have no idea what this is. So this is what this is all about. Memrise. Tom, what the app is that?
This is a language learning app that I'm using to teach myself Spanish and French.
Why? Okay. Before we get to the app, why Spanish and French? Just a desire? Did you not take it in high school?
I actually took Spanish in high school, but living in Los Angeles kind of inspired me to want to get better at Spanish. I also used the same app to brush up on Japanese, not brush up, to learn at all Japanese and Korean before I went to Japan and Korea. And French, I was honestly inspired to learn French because I wanted to listen to Le Rendezvous Tech with Patrick Beja.
Very cool. So what's the hook on this one? Because I know there's like lots of different ways to learn languages and stuff like that. Like, what makes this one special?
Well, I started with Duolingo, which is the more famous language learning app. But I got to the end of it with Spanish, where I didn't have any more lessons. And you basically have to use the website to get to the further things that they offer. And I wanted to have something that was easier and on my app. So I looked around and I found Memrise got some good reviews. And what Memrise does is allows you to find more courses. Like once you hit a beginner's course, you can go to an advanced. They do a very similar thing where they're just kind of working you through it so you don't have to work as hard at memorizing things. They're trying to set you up for success by letting you fail gracefully, but then having lessons that are created based on what you got wrong. So there'll be a brush-up lesson every once in a while. It's like, these are the things you were having a harder time with. Let's just brush up on them. And it works great. And I just like that it's on my phone, because when I'm at a conference like this, I can just be in my hotel room and in 10 minutes, like, do my lesson. It keeps track of my progress. It lets me know how far I am in virtual, in different lessons. And I can go back and repeat a lesson if I really want to.
So is there kind of some intelligence behind it? Like, it figures out, okay, that you're not really getting this concept or this sort of part of the language, and it goes through?
Yeah, it adapts to how fast you're learning as to how fast it teaches you. So it's got a daily goal that it assesses based on how well you're doing. And then, yeah, it has these sort of adaptive lessons based on what you're getting wrong. And one of the things I found out when I started doing the French lesson that was not in the Spanish lesson that I'm doing is they do video. So you get native speakers actually saying the phrases so that you can hear different pronunciations that different people have that, you know, vary by region or just the way people talk.
And does it have like your standard like speech to text kind of recognition so it can recognize what you're saying? I think Duolingo had that. I'm a little familiar with that. So yeah. Is it similar?
Yeah, it does have that option if you want to use it. Same way as Duolingo. You can turn it on or turn it off.
Very, very cool. And then you mentioned it has kind of more lessons, additional lessons. I'm assuming there's some sort of pricing model built into that. Like, how does it work? Is it a free app, paid app, subscription?
Yeah, it's free to use, but I actually pay the subscription fee for it because that gives you unlimited access because they have their own in-house lessons, but they also allow people to create lessons on the platform. And so there's a limit to the number of lessons you can access per month. If you do it for free, but if you pay the amount, you have an unlimited access. So I've done that so that I can have a bunch of different languages.
Right. And the phone just went blank, and I was going to say the name of the app again.
Memorize. Yeah.
Like Memorize, but R-I-S-E.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Awesome. Tom, thanks for talking with us and doing What the App Is That. I know you're always involved in like lots of projects. You got your podcast and stuff like that. Anything extra you want people to know about that you're up to?
Yeah, in addition to Daily Tech News Show, I also write books. So if you're interested in a science fiction story about a time traveler, check out Pilot X. You can find it at tommerrittbooks.com or wherever books are sold.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tom.
You bet.
So there you go, Nerdtacular 2017. I had a ton of fun. Apparently, you can also tell in there, I didn't notice this till I was listening back, but Nerdtacular happens at Snowbird in Utah, and it's up about, I want to say, 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And if you go up to the peak, it's like 10,000 feet, something like that up. Yeah, it's a little hard to breathe up there. You struggle for air. And if you get too excited like I do when I'm talking to these guys, I think you can tell that a little bit. But anyway, it was a ton of fun. Check out the videos online. Also, check out all of the pics and the great shows and stuff over on the Frog Pants Network. If you are looking for new shows and you don't know about those, check it out. Lots of great stuff. Some of my favorites are Film Sack, where the guys just get together and they watch campy old movies and they do commentary on them. It's not Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's a little bit different than that. It's kind of commentary after the fact, and they just analyze the films and lots of great jokes and stuff like that. The Morning Stream, which is Scott and Brian's morning show that happens every day. That's great and funny, and they do a bunch of great segments in there. And there's just a ton of great shows. The Instance, if you're into World of Warcraft, I mean, go over to the network and check it all out. Of course, Tom's The Daily Tech News Show is just something that should be in everybody's feed, probably. So check that all out. But I think with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great apps, get more information and details on their software by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can check them out at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails, your audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, including all of the links to the great applications that were mentioned in What the App Is That, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google+, our Google Plus community can be found at google.com/PlusMacCast. Thanks for hanging out with me for another episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.